This week on the Back Table Podcast.
The whole concept of crying for pain, I think, is, you know, I feel like I was able to bring that here, and we're still developing it, trying to get, you know, everyone interested. So that's really been something enjoyable that I learned quite a bit about it at Emory with Dr. Prologo. The genicular thing really is just that one particular area. We've had a lot of good luck with, you know, for instance, palliative care in the hospital with treating a lot of cancer-related pain.
Welcome to the Back Table Podcast, your source for all things endovascular or otherwise minimally invasive. You can find all previous episodes of the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or backtable.com. First, a brief word from our sponsors. Today's Backtable Podcast is sponsored by Boston Scientific Interventional Oncology and Embolization Division. Boston Scientific Interventional Oncology and Embolization is a global provider of medical devices. Boston Scientific's goal is to become the leading partner by enabling and developing minimally invasive procedures. Boston Scientific recently received 510K approval for expanded indication of the Visual ICE cryoablation system for palliation of pain associated with metastatic lesions involving bone in patients who have failed or are not candidates for standard radiation therapy. As the only manufacturer with this indication on label for cryoablation in the United States, Boston Scientific remains dedicated to supporting the further growth of cryoablation technology in order to provide expanded treatment options for patients. Now, back to the show. This is Michael Barraza recording in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I'm honored to welcome Dr. Aaron Shari with Vascular Interventional Physicians in Memphis. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, Michael, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on and get a chance to hang out with you while we're both on call this weekend.
So. Yeah, we both got killed last night.
Yep, we did, but that's okay. We got a little break here. So
yeah, you had two embolizations last night?
Yep, two embolizations, and looks like a few more piling on for later.
So I got
if I get up and run out, that's why.
I get it. I had a stroke and a trauma, and so far it's been quiet this morning. I'm scared to use that word, but today we're talking about cryoneurolysis for pain interventions for benign and malignant conditions. And before we get into that, I want to talk with you a little bit about your practice. Tell me a little bit about where you work, the structure, and what things have been like for you there.
Yeah. So I am in Memphis, Tennessee, in an independent private practice group called Mid-South Imaging, and sort of our interventional subsidiary of that is Vascular Intervention, Interventional Physicians. And we're a mid-sized private practice group. There's about eight interventional radiologists, and we cover a hospital system really within Tennessee, Mississippi, Arkansas, and throughout other areas of Tennessee. And we also have two OBL setups here where we do outpatient cases in clinic. That's kind of the makeup of our group here in Memphis. So,
how do you guys split the cases between the hospital and the OBL? And are you, do you work at both?
Yeah, we do. We all kind of rotate through both. You know, within the hospital, we're doing the basic hospital cases that you would see, you know, servicing the inpatients and higher acuity cases. And things like that. We have a pretty active and busy clinic. And so within our OBL space, we get a lot of referrals, and we're seeing patients in our clinic and kind of managing them through time. And that's really where we're doing more of our elective work. And so, you know, like anyone else who works in a hospital, it's incredibly challenging, even more so in this day and age, to do elective outpatient cases in the hospital. You know, I think that really has defined the need for some of these outpatient facilities for so many reasons. But what I've noticed since I've been working in OBL is the patient care is exceptional.
I'm sure.
And it's just so much nicer for them, for us, to really treat these patients efficiently in a timely manner. You know, they're much more comfortable, and you can get a lot more done.
I'll bet. So, how long has your OBL been open?
So I joined the practice in 2021. I think the OBL had been open for about a year and a half prior to that. And so it's really grown quite a bit. We had, you know, one of my partners, Henry Dalsania, who was really, you know, our innovator as far as that goes, had proposed this to the group. and they sort of took a chance on it, you know, just like any other practice. It's a lot of uncertainties, and it really took off immediately. You know, it was a gamble, and it's been a success ever since, and we've grown immensely. You know, now we're in our third, fourth year, and in really seeing a lot of patients. In fact, we've opened a second OBL in our Mississippi area that is underway now with clinic, and we'll be opening our actual procedural rooms here later this year.
That's awesome that, you know, you have the type of practice where, you know, taking a risk like this is supported by, you know, a combined IR-DR group.
Yeah, it's definitely unique in that we get a lot of support from the group as a whole. And, you know, I think that's because we've done well for the practice. You know, we've established the need for the community. You know, I think our value has sort of shined that way. And so yeah. Our DR colleagues are really supportive of it. They want us to go out and practice build and promote IR. You know, we've got a marketing team. Then we, you know, we're out there in the community with, you know, commercials and brochures and events and trying to create this awareness. And it's nice to be in a practice that supports that and is not just, oh, you know, you guys got to just stay on the list and read. So I think it's a unique situation, especially with all the hot debate and topics about various practice models and IR and DR and, you know, independent IR and things like that. I think it's a sort of a unicorn, if you will, of private practice groups where IR and DR really mesh well together.
Yeah, I am in a group where IR and DR work well together as well. And it, you know, it certainly changes that conversation for me. You know, the all IR, all DR side, you know, that argument is different for me just based on my own experiences.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. So, and prior to coming here, I've had a varied experience from the onset of graduating and coming out of training. You know, we were talking earlier, you know, you and I were both in practices in Nashville, and that was a much different experience for me.
Yeah,
as
too.
Far as, you know, IR and DR in a private practice group, and, you know, really wasn't exactly what I was expecting or looking for, and kind of learn as you go. And ultimately, it sort of led me to my next chapter, which was joining up in academics at Emory University. And so had the opportunity to have that whole academic experience of IR, where you're doing 100% IR, you know, all kinds of crazy cases all day long. And that was enjoyable. I learned a lot. And really all that kind of led me to this current practice, especially with regard to pain intervention. We'll get into that later, but it's definitely shown me different aspects of academics and private practice and just really what you can do almost anywhere you go.
So, you know, you talked about your time at Emory, and that's really where you got, you know, your start with these pain interventions, or at least certainly that's where you built a lot of the base you're using now.
Yeah. You know, when I was in Nashville, we did do a lot of MSK type pain procedures,
yeah.
Injections, ESIs. We did some spine work, kyphoplasties.
That sounds just like my old job.
Right.
In Nashville.
Right. A lot of joint injections, you know, SI joints and, you know, various, you know, shoulder, hip, what have you. So that was really the first time I got familiar with that type of work. I'd done some in residency, really hadn't done a lot of that in fellowship. And so I got more savvy with sort of that bread and butter type intervention. And then when I went to Emory, you know, of course, I had the opportunity to work with David Prologo out there, who, you know, really changed my whole perception of pain intervention with everything that he was doing. And, you know, you guys had him on the show a while back, and it was a really great podcast and insightful. And, you know, fortunately for me, I got to be there firsthand to work with him and learn from him. And that was, you know, the first time I even heard the word cryoneurolysis.
Yeah.
And so really everything I know and do now was influenced from, you know, his teachings and his mentorship. And I've been able to extrapolate a lot of that into our current practice.
So when you took your job in Memphis, was there, you know, much being done in the way of pain interventions?
Not a whole lot. The group really was doing a lot of, you know, PAD, venous work, and really, really everything else. But I think the one area that was lacking was in the pain realm. And even, you know, injections and things like that, we weren't doing a whole lot of. But, you know, we had a fairly robust oncology service. And, you know, we had a lot of patients with metastatic disease and, you know, various mets to bone and spine. And so there were a lot of these patients out there that, you know, had these pain syndromes that really weren't recognized or weren't having interventions sort of made aware. And I think that gave me an opportunity to come here and start, you know, advertising that we can do some of these things. The group I'm currently in has a very solid relationship with orthopedics. We do a lot of the MSK diagnostic work, and that led to a lot of opportunities for non-cancer related pain intervention as well, beyond just the injections and joint interventions and spine work. And so, as we'll get into in a little bit, you know, this practice has really afforded a lot of opportunity for, you know, both cancer and non-cancer related pain interventions with a lot of interest and support.
So how did you, you know, start building this? In particular, how did you get the word out to these different doctors that, like, look, I'm here. There's a lot that we're not doing that we can be for pain.
Yeah, that's always a great question. You know, I think back on it and I try to remember specific instances. You know, one example that comes to mind is with our orthopedic surgeons, which we have a really close relationship with through our, you know, kind of MSK radiologists. And, you know, there were a couple of instances, you know, we were starting to do some genicular artery embolization. That was something we had done a little bit at Emory. They were doing some here when I came. And, you know, it was just an interesting service line. I think a lot of folks are really trying to understand it and get more into that. And there's certainly some good data that's starting to, you know, unfold as well. And so we would go to our orthopedic colleagues. In fact, our OBL and office is in a building with one of our ortho conglomerates here that we work with. They're just downstairs. And so
nice.
We would go down there and, you know, market to them and say, hey, do you guys treat knees? And of course, we know they do. And,
yeah.
And they did. And so, you know, we kind of pitched some of these interventions like genicular nerve block and ablation and genicular artery embolization. And we said, we could definitely try to help you guys out and collaborate. You know, I know that there are patients who potentially are not operative candidates for a total knee arthroplasty or that need to potentially get to a point where they can have one if it's, you know, physical therapy, losing weight, things like that. Or even, you know, there's always this handful of patients that have had a total knee arthroplasty that just have not received the pain relief that they were wanting. And so, you know, our kind of pitch was, hey, we can help with some of these patients. And it is not a competitive service line whatsoever. I mean, these guys do a lot of knees and they have a lot of patients that still have some pain, or of the hundreds and hundreds they do, even the handful tends to be a big volume.
Yeah. That's been my experience too.
And as soon as we said that, they were like, yeah, where do we send them? And so, you know, we started doing a lot of knee intervention, and I can kind of tell you a little bit later sort of how that algorithm has unfolded for us. We're still trying to work through it.
I'm making my way through my own algorithm. I'd love to talk about it.
Yeah. And it's been a great service, because in no way, again, is it competitive whatsoever. I mean, they love this.
It's, you know, it's great.
They failed injections. They failed conservative management. They, you know, this is just another option. And so I had one surgeon who does a really high volume of total knees. And this is out at one of our peripheral sites in the hospital. And I was talking to him one day, just randomly in the hospital, I think in the doctor's lounge, and sort of pitched this idea. And, you know, he sent me a couple patients. We did a nerve block, good response. We did the genicular cryoneurolysis. And the first few had incredible response. I mean, just pain-free, went to physical therapy, rehab, recovery, did great. After that, this one physician just started sending, in 3 months, he sent 85 referrals.
God.
And so, you know, it really overwhelmed the system. And I tell people too, you know, that's another thing. Sometimes you got to be careful. If you open these floodgates, you can definitely get overwhelmed with just a large number of patients.
Yeah.
And we were at one point for a few months when we were doing, 3 to 4 of these knee cryos a week out there. It definitely, it put a blip on the hospital radar. They saw this sort of, you know, under, you know, they don't pay attention to IR all that much.
Right.
But all of a sudden they see this capital cost blip on their, you know, the CFO on their map of all these probes being used. And it brought some attention because we were doing a lot of cases and we were doing a lot of genicular artery embolization as well. So we really had this bustling knee program. I can talk more about later, but you know, that was just at one site. And so to sort of answer your earlier question, that was, you know, how we kind of got into this sort of non-cancer related joint pain with knees and have started to build that service line. And two, you know, we've gotten my partners involved in that. So now they're doing knee interventions as well. And they really weren't doing that prior to. And so that it's been nice to kind of all work together to offer that pain service and try to figure it out.
So the pain stuff that was getting done already, I know you said it wasn't too much that was getting done in the way of pain interventions, but were they using cryo?
Not particularly for pain. They were doing a lot of cryo for, you know, renal mass ablations, yeah. You know, some liver, things like that, but really not for pain. So the whole concept of cryoing for pain, I think is, you know, I feel like I was able to bring that here and we're still developing it, trying to get, you know, everyone interested. So that's really been something enjoyable that I learned quite a bit about it at Emory with Dr. Prologo. The genicular thing really is just that one particular area. We've had a lot of good luck with, you know, for instance, palliative care in the hospital with treating a lot of cancer-related pain. Just yesterday evening, we were chatting, I was just finishing up a celiac plexus cryo for, you know, intractable abdominal pain from pancreatic cancer. And so we're seeing a lot of hospital patients now, they're consulting us, they're becoming more aware of these patients who are just unable to get out of the hospital, whether it's from, you know, metastatic disease, you know, soft tissue mets to the pelvis or abdomen or spine disease or intercostal neuralgia or, you know, various etiologies. So that's a whole nother area that's really started to develop for us in the pain realm.
So this is going to be kind of a tough question because, you know, I know you said this is still developing, but I'm curious where all you're using cryo, you know, just for full disclosure for me, I've only been doing it for pudendal neuralgia. I've done one intercostal and then the occasional bone tumor in addition to, you know, other cancer ablations. But for pain, that's really all it's been for me. I'm using RFA for the genicular nerve ablation.
Yeah, probably the most common areas that we use it for, you know, I would say if we're kind of breaking it down into cancer versus non-cancer, for a lot of the non-cancer stuff, we're doing a fair number of genicular, like I mentioned, pudendal nerve, some stellate ganglion. We're doing a little bit of that work as well. I know you guys had Alexon not too long ago, a great podcast about stellate ganglion. We were doing a lot of that at Emory, and it's kind of where, again, I got bold enough to even want to try that here. And so we're doing some of that, intercostal nerve, ilioinguinal, genitofemoral for inguinodynia. We will see some occasional phantom limb. I've tried to create some awareness for that, and we'll see, you know, a few here and there. Did a recently desmoid tumor that was sort of encroaching on occipital. It was like a head and neck desmoid that had some occipital encroachment on a younger patient. And so benign or somewhat malignant soft tissue tumor type etiologies. We will do a fair number of celiac interventions, mostly malignant, but some non-malignant. Recently, just a few months ago, had a younger female who had median arcuate ligament syndrome. She had a release and had a lot of scar tissue in the area, had a couple ethanol blocks that really faded for her fairly quickly, and she found us and were able to do a celiac cryo for her. And so that's some of the stuff we're doing for the non-cancer related type pain. For the cancer related stuff, we're doing a lot of celiac, plexus cryoneurolysis, splanchnics, intercostal for tumor or lung cancer, pudendal, obturator, and then a lot of just soft tissue mass, you know, encroaching on nerves and things like that, sacral masses. We'll do occasionally see some rectal pain where we're trying to figure out various targets, usually based on some type of soft tissue deposit in the pelvis encroaching on some nerve or certain areas.
I mean, that's incredibly varied. I don't have to Google some of these nerves. But, you know, I would imagine in order to do this, you have to have a very good understanding of neurologic supply to these areas. You know, I mean, I would imagine that's a challenge is for these patients that are just sent to you for undisclosed pain. How do you break down where this is coming from and what to target?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll kind of defer back to my time, you know, working with Dave Prologo. You know, when I first sort of started learning about this stuff, I was at one of our peripheral hospitals that was kind of a sister hospital to the one that he worked at. And, you know, someone called one day and said, "Hey, got a patient with abdominal pain. Can you do one of those ablations that you guys do?" And I said, well, hold on, let me call you back. And I called Dave and I said, "Hey, somebody's calling me about doing some type of nerve ablation. You know, what is that? You know, what do I tell them?" He said, "Well, call him back and tell him yes, and then call me back."
And that's
so
awesome.
I would get a lot of these calls, and he would sort of walk me through, you know, how to treat these patients and sort of an algorithm of really how to work this up. And one thing I learned was that the procedures, as interventional radiologists, the procedures, once you figure out what you're supposed to do, are really quite easy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're talking about CT guidance, placing a needle to a certain part of the body and turning a switch on and freezing it. And I mean, we do that all day for biopsies and drain placements. I mean, we can target anything. And so what I learned, and to kind of answer your question, is that the hardest part of this is really just trying to figure out what to target. And if your patients or anything like mine, you know, you never get a straight story or a clear history. It's, you know, "Do you have pain?" And the answer is yes. And you say, you know, "Where is it?" And they say, "It's everywhere. You know, it's all over. I feel it all the time." It's really one of these mysteries you've got to break down and try to understand exactly, you know, where this pain generator is in the body, how you can target it, what nerve, you know, are we talking about? And so what I'm still learning is sort of the art of trying to work these patients up.
Yeah.
And that to me is really the hardest part, because you rarely get a history of like straight up pudendal neuralgia where someone comes in and just gives you the textbook answer and you're like, "Oh, that's pudendal neuralgia." It really took a lot of learning how to talk to patients and sort of how to understand, you know, how to interpret what kind of pain they're really in. And a lot of times they're not going to tell you. You've got to sort of, you know, read their body movement and their and sort of how they're, you know, are they just in bed bound and lying, you know, is the pain sharp, is it tingling, is it radiating, is it exacerbated by certain things? It may not tell you that. A lot of times you've got to look to ancillary history from family or try to understand what their baseline was, or you know, what they were doing before some of these pain syndromes happened. And so a lot of it is just in the workup. I think once you figure that out, the procedure part is really not that hard.
And you talk about the pain, like tingling or radiating. Why does that matter? Does it just help you localize, you know, where it's coming from?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, there are different types of pain, whether it's, you know, neuropathic or, you know, nociceptive, or if it's more autonomic, or you know, I think that can really help you isolate if, you know, nerve is potentially involved, you know, especially with some of these, you know, low back pain, joint pain, some of these non-cancer related things where, you know, there can be so many etiologies of pain that is not necessarily just a nerve. I think too, when sort of working these patients up, one thing I've learned over time is really trying to calibrate expectations as well, because, you know, pains are really vulnerable and hard area to work. And these patients are really, they're desperate for a solution. And, you know, if you're, you come in there and you say, "I can help you," you know, you've got to be careful sometimes to say,
"Totally.
You know, I'm not sure I can take your pain to a 0 out of 10. I want to, and I'm going to try." But, you know, the reality is if you're a 10 out of a 10 and I can get you to a 5 or a 6, that's a huge win.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we can get you even lower, that's just a bonus. But I think really trying to calibrate expectations and just being, you know, forthcoming with the patient, depending on what you're treating, goes a long way.
Man, I think that's such a great point. And I think that for me is probably the biggest challenge. Not putting the needle in. It's setting expectations when I am, you know, still kind of learning about this myself. I mean, this isn't a, you know, an old established intervention, you know, cryoneurolysis. And, you know, it was hard to think back to the first time I did one for pudendal neuralgia. And I just had to be very honest. Like, I don't know, you know, how long this is going to take, how long it's going to last, but I know that there's good data for this and we should give it a shot.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing, you know, we're still trying to generate data. And, you know, I think we were talking about it earlier. You know, we do a lot of cases. I'm not really a data guy. You know, I'm not the guy out there doing the research. I'm not the innovator. Those are the, you know, the Prologos of the world,
right?
And the you know, the Jack Jennings, Sean Tuttons, the Doug Beals of the world, who are amazing. Those are the leaders and the innovators. And, you know, I'm just a guy out here doing cases. And so, but, you know, the more you do, you learn a lot. And I, you know, anecdotally feel like we've helped a lot of people. And, you know, the research is so important because I think we need to get these things validated and approved and have insurance on board and really make sure that we can, you know, keep offering these procedures.
Absolutely.
To people that need them. So I'm totally on board with the concept that, you know, we need that research. And but it's a challenge when people ask, you know, well, I Googled this and really there wasn't a lot out there. I'm not sure what cryoablation of the nerve is, and, you know, what are the outcomes and how long is this going to last, and you know, what are the complications? And so those can be challenging questions because we're still learning that.
Yeah. But I've also found that, you know, this is a subset of patients, the ones that are in bad pain, that are the most desperate to have improvement. They're like, look, you know, you got something new, fuck it, let's try it. And it does make it a little bit easier, one element of that conversation.
It is. And, you know, pain, it's just, there's so many people out there that have it. It really, there is a need for, I think, what we can offer. And, you know, the whole, there's a lot of talk out there about the opioid crisis, and it's real. I mean, we have so many patients that are just hooked to opioids, and really they're maxed out on their doses. You know, you see them in the hospital, they're just gorked out. It's miserable. I mean, just this guy just treated yesterday, you know, sad story, 45-year-old guy with metastatic pancreatic cancer. I mean, 45, and just the nicest person. He was, you know, very functional, still functional, and was just completely gorked out on narcotics and really just, you know, could barely stay awake, but still had a lot of pain, and it's terminal, and he wants to spend time with his family, and he wants his remaining time to be, you know, as meaningful as possible. And so we fortunately were able to do this case. I saw him this morning when I was in the hospital, and he's actually doing really great. And I mean, the response has been really good for just less than 24 hours, which we can talk about a little bit later, sort of, you know, expectations of how people respond post cryoneurolysis. But he's very happy, and he's actually being discharged later this afternoon. And so the hope is he can just go home, be with his family, not be completely maxed out on opioids to where he has some meaningful time left.
Yeah. I mean, when it works, it's the most rewarding thing you've done in a month. I mean, I had a similar guy, young guy with metastatic cancer, this terrible sacral metastasis that nobody could do anything for. Cryoablated it. He did very well, and he died not from that. I mean, he died from his cancer probably like 4 or 5 months later. His family put me in his obituary. I mean, it was an incredible thing. It worked so well. So, Aaron, why cryo? You know, we've got different ways to treat pain. We've got different ablation technologies. We've got chemical ablation. Why cryo?
Yeah, good question, Mike. It's you know, cryo was something I, again, was really introduced to, especially with regard to pain, when I was at Emory and kind of working with Dr. Prologo. You know, we had cryoed other things, renal masses, other soft tissue tumors, so I was familiar with the technology, but I really didn't understand or know the concept with regard why for pain. And of course, you know, there's been a lot of talk on prior podcasts about sort of the pathophysiology of cryo with regard to nerves. You know, you get this whole Sunderland 2 type injury, and really the premise is not just to turn off pain signals, but to induced this whole Wallerian degeneration and you know, neuroregeneration, which was a concept I was not familiar with.
Same.
And so the thought is, you know, not only are we helping the pain on the front end, but there's that potential to create a brand new nerve that essentially didn't have that injury prior to. And so does that create, you know, longer duration of relief? Is that really going to give just a more durable outcome? And I think that's what's really being studied, especially when comparing to other, you know, neurolysis modalities, you know, ethanol, other chemicals, RF ablation, things like that. We've tried to sort of figure out how you can do some studies with the knee, for instance, comparing, say, RF to cryo, and that's not really been done to my knowledge as of yet. But, you know, the thought with the knee, for instance, again, is that you're potentially creating a longer duration of relief. Now, we don't necessarily have that validated yet, but I think that's the thought. And so Cryo, you know, for other reasons, it's, you know, being able to see and visualize the ice ball.
Yeah.
I think for certain areas, it can be a little more gentle on adjacent structures, more controlled as well. I think you can titrate your ice. You can kind of see if it's getting to an area that is not safe, then you've got the ability to halt that and control that. So there are a lot of advantages and that I think are important. And then even coverage, you know, ablation zone coverage, I think is especially with regard to nerves and single probe usage. So those are some of the things that I think are interesting and important about cryo that I learned that could potentially be advantageous.
Aaron, in what circumstances for cryoneurolysis do you do a block first? And if you do you do it the same day or do you do it and then bring them back for the neurolysis?
Yeah, good question. And I know it's probably been talked about before on some other podcasts, but you know, we'll just say, for instance, for non-cancer related pain, almost always I'm doing a block prior to. If it is for, say, the genicular nerve, you know, again, kind of going to our algorithm of sort of how we treat knee pain, a lot of patients were triaging with a block. And, you know, unless they come to us with, you know, recurrent hemarthrosis or things like that, we're kind of going to the block first to see if that works. And if it does, then we're going to the ablation. You know, same with the pudendal and, you know, intercostal and things like that. It's kind of a dress rehearsal for me and for the patient to sort of understand, you know, not only are we trying to test if this is diagnostic, if this is truly your pain generator, but it's going to kind of give you a sense too of what we're doing. And you know, if we're going to commit to the cryo, it gives me a little time. You know, these are usually not urgent cases, so it gives me a little time to coach them and get expectations in order. And then also just to make sure that, you know, before doing a cryo, it's going to work. So I really do block most of the non-cancer pain syndromes if I can.
Yeah, I'm with you. You talk about setting expectations. Let's take, you know, the pudendal, for example. What do you tell them in terms of what to expect after, you know, including when you expect them to have pain relief and how long you expect it to last?
It's a good question. And again, I think that, you know, depending on the etiology of the syndrome and kind of how long it's been going on for, what the inciting injury would have been, I basically tell them, I think this is what you have. And sometimes if it's not clear, then, you know, I make that, you know, I'm upfront and I say, you know, your symptoms seem to point to pudendal neuralgia. You've got some other ones that don't quite add up, but, you know, let's try this block first. And if it is in fact pudendal neuralgia, and we do this block, and I generally do these with CT guidance because I know exactly what I'm targeting and if I'm hitting that target. And I tell them, you know, if basically you get relief from this block, and it won't be subtle, it's going to be, you're going to know, and you're going to be able to tell me that this was a positive response. And if that's the case, then this is the target. This is the pain generator, and you do have pudendal neuralgia. And when we do the cryo, you know, I generally try to counsel them on what I think, and this is after a positive block. You know, I say the cryo is going to help you. You know, here's what I think could happen afterward, you know, for cryoneurolysis in particular, and you know, I think, again, this is kind of alluding back to some of the teachings from Prologo. You know, he talks about sort of his three buckets of responders. And I've had a similar experience, you know, in my practice where you get this first set of responders where they almost get immediate relief, or it's almost like the day after. I did an intercostal cryo recently, and within 24 hours had complete pain relief. And so that maybe is that first, you know, bucket of responders. And then you get kind of this second area where they respond, but it may take, you know, 2 or 3 days. May have, you know, some inflammation, a little bit worse pain, what have you. But in general, it's very mild and short-lived, and they'll get some good pain relief. And, you know, sometimes that could be from a tumor deposit or, you know, encroaching on a nerve, and you kind of release it. And there's that third bucket, which I've had a couple experiences recently where you cryo a nerve, and for weeks and you know, sometimes up to a month, they actually have worse pain.
Yeah.
And I had a lady that I treated for pudendal neuralgia that was one of these, you know, a benign etiology, very athletic. She had done a lot of horseback riding and various things like that. And so we did the block, and, you know, literally like 6 hours after the block, completely pain-free.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it was like a miracle for her, and she had been hurting for years. But, you know, her story was a little bit ambiguous and wasn't sort of this clear cut. You know, she had some lower back pain, she had some other pain that didn't quite fit the bill, but she had enough of the criteria that we thought pudendal was a good option. So after the block, we did the cryo, and I told her, you know, I this is what we might expect. The pain may not be instant. You know, I kind of gave her that whole responder speech, and you could be in one of these areas. Long story short, for about 3 weeks, really about 3 or 4 weeks after the cryo, she had, you know, just almost worse than pudendal neuralgia. I mean, she had this exquisite sensitivity, this vulvodynia. It almost felt like she had like a sunburn around her whole perineal region. And what I learned there and from, you know, various other cases is that you really have to see them in clinic and reassure them. And, you know, I said, look, these, you know, you're kind of in this third bucket here of what I think. And I, you know, my hope and what I know is going to happen is that, you know, this nerve's going to go through a process where there's a lot of inflammation, there's a lot of infiltration, and you've got this worse pain, but it's going to get better. And, you know, after a month or so, a lot of that inflammation is going to subside, and, you know, you get into this sort of Wallerian degeneration part, and then this nerve is going to grow back. And you're, you know, the hope is after some period of time, and it could be weeks to months, you're going to feel better. But now it's a little bit of a long game. And, you know, that's hard for people who were previously athletic and very active. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they're like, what have we done here?
Yeah. My first one I ever did was a very similar story and a very similar result. And I'm the one that needed the reassurance. Like, I called Prologo in a near panic. I'm like, what happened? He's like, it's fine. Just cool off.
Yeah. And I think that's another testament to cryoablation. Really, you know, it's got that profile of creating, you know, a nerve injury that's reversible, and that's the intention. And so, you know, there's some reassurance there. And again, I think it's just counseling the patient, making sure they understand, you know, I'm going to get you through this, and it's going to take some time, but that can be a challenge. I had one younger lady I did a stellate cryoneurolysis on. And again, we did the block. Now, she had left-sided complex regional pain syndrome.
Uh-huh.
And we don't do a high volume of these. So every time I do them, it just, you know, kind of like, all right, we're going to do this. But she did great on the block, and then brought her back and did the cryo. And a lot of the symptoms she was having with the complex regional pain went away and did great. But I think what happened is my ice ball potentially clipped kind of an inferior C7 cervical nerve root.
Mm-hmm.
And so she got this, just these motor deficits in her left arm that, you know, she barely lift her arm. And that was terrifying. I was like, oh gosh, what's happened here? And so it took it took a good 6 months to get her through that to where she's doing great now. In fact, she's super happy because now, you know, the arm is essentially repaired and the all the symptoms she was having from the complex regional pain are essentially gone. But, you know, you get these cases where these things happen and you've got to really work through it and reassure them and let them know, you know, these motor components will come back. And so I found that to be, you know, a learning process and a challenge that we do a lot of other types of procedures, you know, uterine fibroids and various things where, or, you know, even with kyphoplasty, things like that, where you just, when you're done and you don't necessarily have to continue kind of coaching your patient through the process and reassuring them. So there's that sort of, you know, labor intensive component sometimes of pain and pain intervention.
Absolutely. And I don't think this is something that I would have been able to handle before I had a clinic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been said, you know, a million times over, but, you know, the clinic is, it's really more, you know, I used to think, well, you know, you should have to have a clinic. That's what everyone says. And you got to see your patient. But more and more, I understand why. And you know, it's, you know, I have the ability to schedule a patient weekly for follow-up if they're able to come and see me. And like having that freedom to do that, really, it's good for me. It's good for the patient. You know, and I don't see patients every week like that. But if I have a patient that had an sort of an adverse event like that I need to just make sure we get them through it, then, you know, having a clinic is so pertinent to be able to do that.
Very much. And it's also helpful to have a clinic nurse who is used to handling these phone calls. It's like, you're all right, you know, and, you know, they're not panicked too. I've got a great clinic nurse.
Yeah. You probably know it. I mean, it takes a lot of education too, right? I mean, how much pain intervention did your clinic nurse sort of have? How much background did they have prior to seeing these patients? I mean,
none. You probably she was a urology nurse, and we took her.
You know, I think there's a big learning curve with managing these patients, and like I said, doing the procedures is, once you figure that out, is the easy part.
Yeah. There is one procedure I'd like to go through in detail, and that's how you're doing the celiac cryoneurolysis. First of all, you know, what has your experience been like comparing cryoneurolysis to chemical neurolysis for either benign or malignant, you know, pain related to the celiac plexus?
Yeah, another great question. I have been fortunate enough to do quite a few celiacs, or unfortunate enough, I don't know. Either way.
Fortunate that you can do it. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I was doing all as an all neurolysis when I first started doing these and, you know, even back in fellowship and shortly thereafter. And then, when I started doing the cryo, when I came to Emory, you learned a lot of different things. And so, you know, one thing we found with ethanol is that, you know, sometimes these patients would get this transient diarrhea, GI effect syndrome. And I remember I had this one older guy who was actually a friend of mine. It was his dad and did a, you know, a pancreatic cancer, did an ethanol neurolysis, completely pain-free within 24 hours. Did
unbelievable.
Amazing. And then he had this horrific diarrhea syndrome for like 3 weeks.
3 weeks?
3 weeks. And he was hospitalized with it and all his metabolites were deranged and he was dehydrated and just was really sick from the diarrhea.
Yeah.
The GI, you know, they were putting on these octreotide regimens and like all these crazy things. And that was a more dramatic presentation. But yeah, I would see, you know, this kind of diarrhea phenomenon happen in, you know, 30 to 40% of these patients. And when we started doing more cryo, you know, we noticed and we weren't having these GI side effects, but we were still getting, you know, pain responders. And, you know, we put a paper out in JVIR some years ago, kind of comparing the two and with that data in mind. And so, you know, that was one sort of difference that I noticed. And, you know, some of the other things with celiac, you know, I often do mine with general anesthesia if I can, because, you know, putting those needles in such a sensitive space, number one, it's just easier if you can have the patient asleep and not moving. You know, other things I started to notice and with some consistency is that, especially for the metastatic cancer patients who were not always optimized. You know, electrolytes were off. They were dehydrated. You would do these cryos, and oftentimes, you know, you'd get these sympathetic reactions where their blood pressures would, you know, would drop. The systolic would drop, you know, into the 60s and 70s. And then you would put them on a thaw, and, you know, potentially you were maybe close to the adrenal gland, or occasionally would get this sort of catecholamine effect where, you know, all of a sudden the systolic jumps and, you know, to 280, 290. And, you know, we were trying to do this with just an IR nurse and a blood pressure cuff, and we couldn't keep up. And so a lot of times, if I have the resource, you know, I'll have anesthesia, we'll start an ART line, and you can just monitor that blood pressure throughout. And so that's one way I try to do them, and just to sort of manage the blood pressure changes that we'll see with this.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense too, just having such a tight control of the ablation zone. When I'm using ethanol, after I inject it, I almost don't want to look. Like, I almost don't want to scan it and see where it's gone, because it just, it goes so much farther down than the celiac plexus. But targeting has got to be more of a challenge, I would think. I mean, it's a bigger needle than you're using for an ethanol neurolysis. How do you approach that? You know, how many probes are you doing? Do you go anterior, posterior? Like, how do you do it?
Yeah, generally, you know, I have these patients prone. I'm going posterior, you know, sort of posterior, bilateral, pericural. And essentially, I'll use usually something like an ice rod or something that's got more of an oval, you know, front to back type of morphology. And I tend to target the plexus. You know, it's this three-dimensional network that runs from the celiac axis to the SMA, and it sort of goes anterior around the aorta, and you kind of go posterior back into the splanchnix. When I'm targeting, I'm usually a little bit down closer towards the SMA, just for anatomic reasons. And, you know, I'll get my two probes in, CT guidance. I kind of get the tips anteriorly sort of aligned with the aorta. You know, what I'm hoping is that I'm getting sort of an anterior to posterior growth of the ice ball from the celiac plexus sort of back toward the splanchnix.
Okay.
And with CT, obviously, you can get a very precise and safe localization.
Right.
Where things to look for are your proximity to the adrenal gland. Obviously, you know, sometimes there can be little intercostal or paraspinal arteries around that area you just sometimes can see and obviously want to try to avoid. Usually, you're not ablating back to the kidney or you know, there's not like bowel or other things in the way. So as far as any type of collateral issue, there's not a whole lot. And people will sometimes ask, well, you know, if you're sort of nudged up against the aorta, do you ever worry about the ice hurting the aorta? And I tell them no. I mean, there's so much heat sink in these vessels that, you know, I've had ice balls grow directly into the aorta, and it's just not going to hurt.
Not going to do anything.
That's generally my approach to these with the needle. I will say one thing I like about cryo over ethanol is, especially with soft tissue tumor, if you've got lymph nodes or infiltrate, if you've noticed with ethanol, sometimes you inject and it just kind of goes around the tumor, gets absorbed into the tumor, or the tumor even boxes it out from the nerves. And so I think cryo has the advantage of really targeting the plexus. Even in the event that you've got soft tissue kind of encroaching or encasing the area where the celiac plexus is.
Yeah. You mentioned for celiac plexus, when available, you're doing general anesthesia. Are you doing the majority of the other ones under moderate sedation?
I am. The majority is under moderate sedation. You know, and usually these are single probe peripheral nerves, quick, you know, intercostals, pudendals, for the most part under moderate sedation.
When you're doing the intercostal, do you worry about the ice ball being, you know, right along the pleura?
I don't. I haven't had any issue, knock on wood, with any pleural injury. You know, it's a relatively safe space. Occasionally, you know, you've got to do maneuvers to protect the skin if you have a thinner patient or things like that. But I haven't, you know, had any issue with the pleura itself.
For the various pain interventions that you're doing with cryo and other modalities, are there any circumstances where you look at it and just like cryo is not appropriate here?
Not sure that I necessarily think that for cryo specifically, but certainly for ablation in general.
Yeah.
You know, obviously with with nerves that have a heavy motor component or potentially nerves that are in areas where there could be some other collateral damage issues next to bowel or things that aren't, you know, as forgiving toward even cryo, you know, I tend to think twice about doing that. For instance, superior hypogastric blocks, I used to do a lot of those when I was, you know, for UFE. I don't do that as much now, but
neither.
You know, never really cryoed that space. I had done a couple where I had to take this sort of very angulated posterior approach to even get to that area, but the geography of that bundle is just difficult to get to with cryo probes. And so, you know, some of it too is just anatomically, is it safe for me to get there?
So do you use the same general freeze thaw cycle for each of these?
For the larger nerve bundle, say like celiac plexus, I am still generally doing somewhere around a 10-5, 10-5, you know, with passive thaws. Now, if we're doing pudendals, I do kind of subscribe to that sort of 8-3-3-3 pattern that Dr. Frilogo described. And then, you know, things for, you know, for geniculars, generally just doing some type of single freeze and thaw. So anywhere from, you know, 8 or 9 minute freeze with a 5 minute passive thaw. For the most part, for smaller peripheral nerves, we're just talking a single freeze, single thaw.
For the geniculars, how many probes are you doing?
I'm doing currently 3 probes.
Yeah.
We don't do the suprapatellar area. We're basically just doing the superior, medial, lateral, and inferior medial nerves.
Do you do them all at once or one at a time? You know, my problem when I'm doing them is that if I'm doing multiple probes and it's not a particularly heavy patient, I have to have somebody hold the probe in place. I can't hold all of them at the same time because they all kind of veer off a little bit.
Yeah, I do all 3 at the same time. And really that shorter ice sphere probe that Boston Scientific makes has been really useful for things like the knee and areas because it's only about 10 centimeters. And so, you know, it's perfect for that space because you don't have the shaft that's sort of tilting your probe over and torquing it. And then, you know, it's like impossible to sort of, you know, get your cords situated. So those are really good for the intercostals and geniculars. And, you know, occasionally when we're doing things like the phantom limb or anything in the leg, those are really useful for that type of real estate where you just don't have a lot of skin purchase and purchase into the tissue.
Got it. Aaron, that's about all I got. Is there anything else that I didn't go over that you want to talk about?
I think the only other thing, you know, we had sort of talked about it earlier in the podcast about just, you know, some of the cases we do in the OBL versus the hospital. And I thought that would be an interesting thing to discuss. We do a lot of different things in our OBL from, you know, PAD to Y90 to prostate, genicular artery, UFE. I mean, we do everything and you know, we do various ablations, including pain. Earlier on, we were doing more cryoneurolysis in the OBL. And yeah, I think one of the challenges so far in that landscape with cryo and pain in particular is we're still navigating the insurance and reimbursement and things like that. I know there's a lot of leadership out there with SIR and various committees and pain committees trying to get, you know, some of these codes forwarded on and approved and get these things validated so that we can essentially get paid to do this work. But you know, when we were doing some of these cases, for instance, I about 3 weeks ago did a pudendal in our OBL, you know, occasionally we were doing a lot more geniculars. We'll do an intercostal here and there, but you know, one of the main issues we've been having with that is really just reimbursement.
Okay.
But that aside, you know, it is so nice to do them in the OBL. We actually have a setup where we have CRNAs and we do propofol for our patients. And so it's really conducive to doing these types of procedures. We have a GE mobile C-arm that does cone beam. And so, you know, it's very efficient. We're able to cone beam our prostates and, you know, we'll even do some of our Y90 mappings, things like that. But, you know, when you cone beam an extremity or pelvis or anything like that, you get really good visualization of bone and muscle. And so we were able to do some of these here. And so that's really nice for the patient. And it really just makes, especially for, you know, patients with pain and cancer and various things, being able to not go to the hospital, being able to
totally
just pull up into a parking lot, check in and be on the table within 30 minutes and asleep. And then, you know, get your procedure and then wake up in this nice luxurious recovery room where you have a single nurse taking care of you and you're watching TV and eating and like, you know, it's just a great experience.
God, you guys are so fancy. Like, what a great setup. Like, cone beam in your OBL and Y90 in your OBL, and I'm a little jealous.
Yeah, no, we're able to do a lot of cool procedures here, and you know, pain really is just a small facet of that. And two, with the cancer patients, with a lot of our PAD patients, things like that. I mean, pain really just goes hand in hand with a lot of our other patient populations. It's just such a great service line because we have, you know, so many patients that are in need of it. And a lot of patients who come in for other things sort of figure out that we're doing some pain interventions, and we end up offering services to these patients who otherwise didn't know there was something out there for them.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, man. Well, thanks for sharing your Saturday. I hope you have a quiet remainder of your call weekend.
Well, I appreciate it, Mike. Thanks for having me on and for taking time from your call experience to chat with me. So
it is an experience.
Yeah, speaking of which, I'm getting paged as we speak. So
I hope it's nothing.
Me too.
All right, buddy.
Well, I appreciate it, man. It's really good to talk to you. So
thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck, Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Ann Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Manbir Singh Subli.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.